stanza only of hymn number 11. May we all stand. O thou of ineffable name, whose everlasting mercy encloses us, whose eternal purpose includes us, whose inescapable call to service commands us, we invoke thy powerful presence to discipline and instruct us through the spoken word by our brother and fellow pilgrim, Walter Brueggemann. And let thy creative and redemptive word not return unto thee void until it do through us the thing for which thou hast sent it by him. To thine own glory through Jesus Christ, our reigning Lord. Amen. Thank you. Dr. Walter Brueggemann is Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of Old Testament at Eden Theological Seminary, a seminary of the United Church of Christ in Webster Groves, Missouri, of which St. Louis is a suburb. Dean Brueggemann has done us a great honor by accepting our invitation to give the Page Lectures this year. It was my privilege to meet Professor Brueggemann in 1969 when he was a volunteer on the Gezer archaeological expedition in Israel. Since then, I've had the good fortune to hear him lecture a few times, but his greatest ministry to me has been through his many fine books. As those of you who've been unable to avoid my courses know, Walter Brueggemann's books are prominent on my required reading list. The book that's been most helpful to me since it came out in 1977 is The Land. It is by far the best thing ever done on the theological meaning of landedness, especially as it has to do with Israel and the Holy Land, the land of promise. And I urge you to read it, and if you'll buy it, he might be able to pay the typist who typed the first copy. By the way, Dr. Brueggemann, some of us have wondered, what in the world does a fellow who's only the dean of a seminary and professor of Old Testament and the husband of one wife and the father of two teenage sons and writes a book a year, what does he do with his spare time? It's remarkable how this gifted scholar has been able to do so many things and to do them all well. Dr. Brueggemann, we want to thank you for coming our way. We invite you back at every opportunity. Our doors, our hearts, and this free pulpit are always open to you. And now we wait with excitement for your second lecture on Anguish Against Common Theology.
Well, what I shall do with my free time from now on is that I shall seek every opportunity I can to be with Baptist friends. You have been stimulating and gracious to me, and those of you who have not agreed with what I have said have been on your good behavior. And faculty colleagues have been inordinately gracious to me, and I have eaten too much. So I thank you for all of that. Yesterday I tried to say that the Old Testament partakes in the common theology of the ancient Near East. I tried to make three major points about that. First, that common theology legitimates social structure, and that's what good religion has to do, because religion cannot live in a social chaos. Secondly, that Israel's common theology testifies to the providence and governance of God, that we live in a world that is safe and will hold together and provides our need for life. And thirdly, I tried to say that in Israel as elsewhere, this common theology always serves a vested interest, and therefore we need to criticize it and be suspicious about it because it always serves the status quo. Now today what I want to say, which you probably is obvious to you, is that the Old Testament is not simply a statement of common theology. There is much else going on in the Old Testament, and therefore I suggest that we really have to do with the crisis in common theology, with the awareness that structure legitimating theology in and of itself is not adequate, because it does not take account of human experience and it does not take account of Israel's discernment of God. The Old Testament is not static. Biblical faith cannot be reduced to any system. It is rather a collage of discernments of God and what Israel has to do with this strange Yahweh. People with this common theology are, as Paul Van Buren says, on the way. And what I want to talk about is that there are two moves in the Old Testament that are kind of against the common theology, and spend some time on those two moves. The second one interests me much more than the first one. The first move that can be observed in the Old Testament, I believe, is the intensification of God's anger as Israel's history moves along. Israel grows more and more wayward, and Yahweh grows more and more harsh. And there is a building of intensity of God's anger through the prophets of the 8th century and the 7th century, finally down to the Deuteronomist and 587, and the terrible pathos of the poetry of Lamentations. And very much of that is caught in the extreme conclusion of Jeremiah, who dares to say that Yahweh wills the end of the city and the people and the temple. And Jeremiah, more than anyone else in the Old Testament, dares to say that Judah has no safe conduct in the world, and that Jerusalem will be a dead crater like Shiloh in the north. And as Israel reflects on this intensification of God's anger, there is not chagrin that the end has brutally come. There is rather amazement that the end has been so long in coming. And so Morton Smith is right. The common theology has its way, and God will put up only with so much. The amazing thing about the Old Testament is that in the midst of all of this storytelling, Israel could still hope. In the heart of God, there is an enormous patience, a holding to the promises, and a resistance to the very theological categories of the common theology. What comes clear in the Old Testament, in the poets and the storytellers, is that Yahweh is really reluctant to be a structure legitimating God. It is Yahweh and not just Israel that has to face up to this incredible incongruity. The incongruity of a God who governs the structures, wanting to have fellowship with this disobedient partner. And that is what the poem of Job is all about. The poem of Job means to argue that God's response is disproportionate to any identifiable guilt. And Job cannot find any warrant for the measure of God's anger. And so perhaps the question of the poem of Job is not, does Job serve God for naught? But does Yahweh judge Israel for naught? And so the intensification of God's anger drives Israel to unthinkable thoughts. And so the Old Testament in this period of God's incredible anger is to think dangerous intellectual thoughts and to make dangerous theological probes against the common theology. And it is my hunch that in a variety of ways, that is what people want pastors to help them do, to make dangerous theological probes around the common theology, because the common theology does not contain or justify everything that is happening to us. But there is not only an intensification of anger. If that is all there were, Israel would be crushed by the unambiguity of structure legitimization, and it wouldn't be very interesting. We would have nothing left to talk about. But Old Testament faith is not simply relentless structure legitimating. The other move that is going on through these pages is that there is the embrace of pain. And so I suggest that the next Old Testament theology must reflect long about what it means in Israel that there is an embrace of pain. Preliminary comments about the embrace of pain. First, that the embrace of pain is always in tension with the legitimization of structure. It cannot be otherwise. It cannot be resolved. That tension is the stuff of human experience, and we may not be romantic about it. Second, that the embrace of pain is always a minority voice. It will never be a majority voice. It will never be the dominant value of any culture until the kingdom comes. It will always be fragile and precarious against the rulers of this age. But it is precisely the embrace of pain that opens the Old Testament to the future. And if you think about that in our own life, it is clear that when we do not embrace pain, all doors to the future are closed, and we can only anticipate an extended present. It is this radical probe of pain that lets the Old Testament run toward the cross in the New Testament, and as Wiesel shows again and again, that lets the Old Testament run toward the Holocaust and still have grieving people claim their Jewishness. Thirdly, preliminary comment, it is the disregard of pain embrace that lets people buoyantly and stridently and uncritically legitimate structure. And there is abundant evidence that when there is no embrace of pain, you can count on it that there will be oppression without compassion, and there will be competence without mercy. The good news of the Old Testament, the good news of biblical faith, is that Israel was at least open to thinking about the meaning of pain in face of the overriding voice of structure legitimization. So what I want to use this time for is to explain, to explore with you, it cannot be explained, it can only be explored, two kinds of pain embrace that are present in the Old Testament, and this data will not be new to you. I only hope that I set it in a different context so that you may perceive it differently. First of all, the restlessness against the common theology is expressed in Israel's practice of pain in the laments of the Psalms. The lament is Israel's primary way of resisting the common theology. The lament is Israel's announcement that the structure cannot be simply legitimated because it isn't adequate. The lament, as a theological activity, takes nerve and faith and risk because it is indeed an assault on the throne of God. It is a dramatic, rhetorical, liturgical act which is irreversible. And once it is uttered, the throne of God cannot be unshaken again. The lament makes clear to the gods in heaven that Israel will no longer be a submissive recipient of decrees from the throne, but that from now on there is going to be a move from the other side that will have its say in the face of God. And so the dynamic that I suggest is that these laments are the nervy voice of pain against the power of legitimacy. And such speech is irreversible. It means that the legitimated structures can never be utterly indifferent again. It is, as a theological act, as irreversible as Rosa Parks refusing to move to the back of the bus. And once that great refusal has been uttered, it can never be the same again. Consider what courage it takes to speak that way. It takes courage because it is new speech, and you don't ever know when you've crossed the boundaries of unacceptability. It takes great risk because Israel never knows how this great Lord will receive it. Such speech might be an act of disobedience. It might be crushed according to the rules of common theology. And so it takes a new kind of faith. It takes not only nerve, but it takes a fresh hunch about God. It takes a hunch that God, who legitimates structure, will tolerate and receive and be impinged upon by this speech from below. It could be that the lament is accounted in heaven as a terrible act of disobedience, but it turns out not to be so. It turns out that the lament is received by Yahweh as a new kind of obedience, and it is disclosed to us that Yahweh does not want submissive peasants, but Yahweh wants people who will carry their pain to break the structure. And if that is a correct judgment about the lament, that means that we have very subversive literature on our hands. It means that obedience needs to be redefined, that it is not bland, docile submissiveness, but obedience consists in caring enough to protest. One of the things we have to reflect on is, why is it that the main body of the church has silenced the laments? While you were singing hymn number 11, I took a little peek in the back of your hymnal And I found exactly what I thought I would find, because I found the same thing in our hymnal. There are no laments printed back there. They have all been censored by the hymnal committee. All the psalms that are printed back there are structure legitimating hymns. And now comes the question to the church in America, whether we are invited to be a new minority movement that will recover that speech for the sake of the pain that is among us. Gerstenberger has suggested that these laments are indeed not laments, but they are complaints. They are not clogging, but they are unclogging. They are not acts of resignation, but they are acts of protest. They are not meditations on trouble, but they are insistences and urgings that things be changed. And they do not doubt that Yahweh is a God who can change the structure in light of the pain. And so the process of the complaint recharacterizes the trouble as something that is now properly Yahweh's agenda. And in the action of the complaint, Yahweh finds himself changed. He is no longer free to be a trouble-free God who presides over a trouble-free structure. The lament redefines the field of Yahweh's sovereignty. And therefore, Gerstenberger is able to say that these complaints, which are indeed acts of anger, are also acts of relentless hope, because Israel does not believe that things must stay as they are. Israel does not believe that things will stay the way they are, because Israel believes that those angry protests are heard and received and acted upon. There is an alternative model of social power presented to us in the laments. Israel does not believe that the doctor always knows best. Israel does not believe that all authority is ordained by God. Israel does not believe that City Hall must always be unfought. This is a rhetorical exercise in uncivil disobedience, which turns out to be a fresh form of obedience. And if you look, you find this alternative way of approaching the throne scattered around the Old Testament in various places. I find it telling that the primal complainer in Israel is Moses, the great lawgiver. I would have thought that Moses would have finished after he gave all this Torah out that covered everything. But there is another side, because Moses is aware that 10 rules do not contain everything that's happening to us. And so he is inordinately defiant to God. And as you know, he throws down the gauntlet to God. He says, if you ain't going to do it, I ain't going no farther. And superbly in Numbers 11, which must be one of the most irreverent pieces of the Bible, he really carries it right to this mother God, and he says, are these my folks? Did I conceive them? Did I bear them? Did I suckle them? No, I didn't. You did, so you take care of them, because I'm not going to. I became aware of how troublesome that is because I wrote a little devotional exegesis for our denominational paper, and the mail ran against it. The mail said, how dare you find that in the Bible? So I had to explain it wasn't me, it was J.E. Dear P. And the amazing thing about these protests is that it is Moses and it is not God who prevails. This is a revolution in heaven and on earth that Israel turns out to have some of the marbles. And Yahweh is a little bit beaten. And Yahweh, as graciously as he can, says, "Oh, all right, we'll do it your way." Well, you know that it's all over the book of Psalms, even though we don't print it in our hymnals. I don't know how to talk about that in such a short time, perhaps to call your attention to Psalm 88, which is the most dangerous of the Psalms, because it just leaves it hanging there. It dares to say, not only have I been shunned, but the verb is a hiphil, and learning Hebrew, it's worth it to learn Hebrew to read that hiphil in Psalm 88. Right. Because he dares to say, you have caused it. Some of you have read Styron's Sophie's Choice. Sophie's Choice, this horrid story about Jews still unpacking the Holocaust, and at the end they commit suicide and their friend is on the bus and he's utterly broken up. And he gets on the bus and he sits next to this black old lady, she's reading her Bible, and she says, "Looks like you're troubled." And she says, "I'll help you through your trouble." And she lines out Psalm 88. She knew. She had not bought in on the structure. She probably wasn't at the back of the bus. What would happen in the church if people knew about these dangerous resources? What gall. And it must be a galling experience for God. But it is an act of hope. Even Psalm 88 is addressed to God. And Psalm 88 waits and is still waiting to see for God's answer. I think that some of you may be old enough to remember Adlai Stevenson about the Cuban missile in the UN, and he had all this data, and he asked a question to the Russian ambassador, and he said, "We're going to wait for your answer till hell freezes over." Israel will wait that long for Yahweh's answer to this complaint. And there is great restlessness in heaven because the other gods say, "I wonder what he's going to do now. I knew he'd get in trouble for entertaining this kind of petition." No conventional response will do. And Israel will give God as long as God needs, but the new answer must change the structure for the sake of pain. Or thirdly, in Jeremiah. You know, Jeremiah really wants to have it both ways. He has these bitter accusations against God who has seduced him. But in the very same poem in chapter 20, after he's accused God of seducing him, he says, "God is my great defense." Well, you cannot have it both ways. Yes, you can have it both ways in biblical faith. I do not think this poem is stated like that because Jeremiah can't make up his mind about whether God is a seducer or a defense. I think Jeremiah puts the question that way because he wants to force God to decide. And the poem is a kind of a multiple choice question to God that says, you check one and you decide who you're going to be now. Jewish faith presses the issue and requires that God re-decide who God wants to be. And that's against all of our neat catechisms that have settled all the issues. The religious life of Israel is permitting God's self-identity to be shattered. It is not different in Job. Whoever wrote Job 9 must have read Numbers 11. Must have said, well, if Moses could get by saying it, so can we. You know what it says. It says, he really is big and strong. And I ain't gonna argue with his strength. But I'll tell you this. Even if I am blameless, he will prove me perverse. He's a liar. He cannot be trusted. It is all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys the blameless and the wicked. He mocks at the calamity of the innocent. Comes the whirlwind. But in the end, even if it's a prose edition, it's still in God's holy word. And in the end, in chapter 42, this amazing thing that we are told that it is not Job's friends, but it is Job who has spoken aright. Unlike all the other gods, the God of Israel is the God who wants his folks alive at the throne with their pain against the structure. It's daring faith and the staggering discernment of Israel is that Yahweh is the one God who will receive it, be impinged by it, and change. So I suggest that Moses, Psalms, Jeremiah, Job provide an important repertoire for how it is in biblical faith. And the outcome of all of that is that the power relationships have been shifted. And what Israel finds out is that very much more has been entrusted to Israel that common theology thought had all been kept in God's own hands. It is a passing of the power in a new direction. So I mean to be suggesting to you that the first restlessness is the restlessness of Israel, who will not permit suffering to be denied for the sake of the common order. But there is a second restlessness that is more surprising. And that is that there are hints on the part of God that God does not want to be known as a structure legitimating God. Now, I have some very delicate assumptions about the nature of the biblical text. I want to talk about three texts with you, and they are obvious texts. But I suggest that these texts are not simply literary fictions of a clever kind that invent another god to keep the play going. Nor do I suggest that these are simply reports about the mind of God, because there is not that match between the text and the mind of God. But rather, these texts are imaginative literary efforts to create new scenes in which the players in the scenes surprise the people who write the play.